So to continue on with the same theme here of these piece-forming materials, I'm going to be looking specifically at gypsum, and I'll talk a little bit about why we chose that and some comparisons. So we mentioned a little bit about some of the issues. Specifically, my research site, or the research site I'm focused on, is on the eastern shore of Maryland. You can see by the arrow there. Hopefully you can see that. We know that Chesapeake Bay eutrophication is a big problem. We know that nitrogen and phosphorus are big sources over there. The eastern shore of Maryland, the Delmarva Peninsula especially, is known for its poultry industry. So for years and years, we've been doing nitrogen-based management plans. So what that's meant is we have really, really high soil test phosphorus levels. We're also looking for ways that we can reduce non-point source reduction, mainly from agricultural areas, and also looking for practices that we can use that can potentially be implemented on farm and be economical. So one possible solution that we came up with, similar to what Dr. Penn talked about, is to use a ditch filter using phosphorus-sorbing materials to directly remove phosphorus from the ditch flow. Some of this will sound pretty familiar. So the objectives of my specific research, or my specific project I'm talking about today, were to determine if gypsum byproducts can be used to remove phosphorus from ditch flows, and to examine some of the benefits and hazards of land application of these materials once they're pulled from the ditch. So the ditch filter design, this diagram should look pretty familiar for those that were at Dr. Penn's talk. We had about 150 feet of ditch. It's a big public drainage association ditch, very, very large structure. 150 feet of that was filled with gypsum. It is byproduct gypsum. I want to reiterate that is, it's not pure gypsum. The ditch was about 13 feet wide at the base and 26 feet wide at the top, so it's a large structure. And as Dr. Penn described, what our hope is that we have this high phosphorus water coming off from the fields in the area. There's also a poultry stacking facility nearby. High phosphorus water coming in and going through this filter material, which the PSM layer is gypsum in this case, and then we have a sand layer that has perforated pipe that we can collect the outflow, and we can monitor the inflow and outflow of the system. So a little bit about the ditch. This is a diagram of the ditch about a little over a year after it was installed. It was installed in March of 2007. So the water is coming in from this direction, from the sides, coming down, hitting the weir, infiltrating, and then we can collect the outflow. It is, the gypsum we use is from flue gas desulfurization, and the specific source for the ditch is U.S. Gypsum Company in Lewistown, Pennsylvania. This is an important distinction because the gypsum I'm going to be talking about in my incubation study is from U.S. Gypsum Company in Baltimore, Maryland. We have found that there are some pretty significant differences in the source gypsum depending where you're getting it from, what type of plant you're getting it from, because it is byproduct gypsum. So going to my specific incubation study, based upon what we did was we took this field study, we looked at the ditch, and we're trying to figure out how we can model this in the lab to figure out the sorption of these materials and if we can re-land apply them. So the first thing I did was to develop an isotherm curve. This is using ICP analysis. So what I did was I did a sequential isotherm, summed the results, and from that we determined the 100% saturation level of this gypsum material. And then from that we could get the 75% saturation and 25% saturation that was used for the incubation study. So the laboratory incubation study was comprised of 288 total cups. Each cup had 200 grams of soil, and then we randomly assigned the treatments to the cups. The treatments I'll talk about in a minute. The soils were each pre-incubated at 25 degrees Celsius for 2 weeks, and they were maintained between 65 and 75% of field capacity. We did destructive sampling. You can see the picture at the bottom right there. At days 1, 7, 28, 63, 91, 119, and 183. For the purpose of today, I'm only going to present the results for day 1, 7, and 28. And for the destructive sampling, the soil was dried at 37 degrees Celsius. We passed it through a 2-millimeter sieve and placed it in storage bags. I'm only going to be looking at phosphorus data today, but right after the first test we ran on any of these was nitrate and ammonia, obviously because of the volatilization issues with that. So we had different treatments here. We had two levels of gypsum based on the mass basis of P. We had a low rate of gypsum, which is 5.6 megagrams gypsum per hectare, and a high rate of gypsum, 22.4 megagrams gypsum per hectare, and the reason we chose that is it ends up being 2.5 tons per acre, which is a typical agronomic rate or a likely agronomic rate, and 10 tons per acre, which is we know is very excessive and is likely you're going to get displacement of magnesium by the high rate of calcium that you're applying. We did the two saturation levels based upon the sorption isotherms again, so this 75% saturation ended up being 18.75 milligrams P per gram of gypsum, and the 25% saturation down here was 6.25 milligrams phosphorus per gram of gypsum. For purpose of our analysis today, I looked at three levels at a time, day 1, 7, and 28. We had four blocks. We had four incubators, which serves as blocks or replicates for this, so we had four different replications of each sample. And we had two different soil types. We had a sandy loam and a silt loam, both collected on the eastern shore of Maryland. We tried to get lower phosphorus soils, which if you know anything about the eastern shore of Maryland, is not easy to do. But we tried to get low background P soils, a sandy loam and a silt loam. So the statistics I'm going to show for my data today, we use, I'm specifically going to be looking at the Malic 3 and the water extractable phosphorus statistics. We use ProcMix. We use a Tukey multiple means comparison test using alpha level of 0.05. We found two significant interactions, which I'll be presenting. We found the gypsum rate by P saturation, as you would expect, would be had a significant interaction, and the soil by day had a significant interaction. So the dip rate by PSAT is averaged across all other factors in the data, and the soil by day is averaged across all other factors as well. So what I want to point out here is I told you the low P, high P, and low gypsum, high gypsum, and this is what they actually equate to. So if you look at this chart, so the low P, low gypsum is only about 35 kilograms P per hectare, and we go all the way up to 420 kilograms P per hectare. So there's huge, huge difference in the amount of phosphorus that we're directly applying to these soils. So these different rates were applied to each of the soil types. So we have four different phosphorus rates here. However, if you look at the calcium, the low gypsum levels are both the same calcium rates and the high gypsum levels are both the same calcium rates. So even though between these two middle treatments, there's not that much difference in the amount of phosphorus we applied, there's a heck of a lot more calcium applied, which you'll see in the data. So this is our first set of data that we collected. It says the effect of P saturation and gypsum rate average across the other factors. This is specifically Malic 3 phosphorus. I also, for statistics sakes, I did not include the control in the comparisons, but I should mention the control soil, which is just the soil with no gypsum, no phosphorus, was 46.5 milligrams per kilogram P, Malic 3 P. And the only one that we found was significantly different was from the others was we found the high P, high gypsum, as you would expect, had significantly higher Malic 3 phosphorus than the other samples. This is the same trend seen in the water extractable P, where the low P, low gypsum, high P, low gypsum, low P, high gypsum were all significantly lower than the high P, high gypsum. And this is going back to our original application rates, basically, is what it breaks down to. Is we know we applied a lot more to begin with, so we wouldn't expect to see too much difference. And this is only up to day 28, so this is average up to day 28. We then broke it down and looked at the effect of soil type and time on both the Malic 3 phosphorus and the water extractable phosphorus. And I should mention, I would love to show you more data. Like I said, we collected samples up to day 183. At this point, we only have the results up to day 28, so that's all I can show you at this point. So the only sample that we found that was significantly higher than the other samples was the day 28 sandy loam sample, and it will be interesting over time to see what happens with that, whether it continues to go out or whether it levels out over time. See a little bit different trend here with the day 1 sandy loam sample and the day 28 sandy loam sample for water extractable P being significantly higher than the day 7 silt loam sample and the day 28 silt loam sample. So what does this mean? What this showed us is the sandy loam has higher water extractable P than the silt loam, and that's because of the clays. We also found that the high P high gypsum has higher Malic 3 phosphorus than the other treatments, and the high P high gypsum has higher water soluble phosphorus than the other treatments, which is going back to that initial application rate, which makes sense. So what does this mean in the real world sense? So some of the conclusions and implications that we have to date. We know that differences exist between soil types. We saw that in the background information. What that means is the spent gypsum will provide or can provide a fertilizer source in less buffered soils. But we must consider the background soil nutrient levels. Of course, we're not going to go applying this to soils that already have excess P on them because we don't want to take that all out of whack. We also know that phosphorus precipitates with calcium in the gypsum and that the soluble phosphorus trapped by the gypsum filters can be returned to the land. It will be interesting to look at more of the data, and we have to consider the long-term effect. We're only up to day 28 right now. But what it appears to us right now is we may be able to re-land apply that gypsum back to the land in a less mobile form, but we're also finding some evidence that it may be plant available. So what that means is we may decrease the environmental consequences. We may not have this stuff easily extracted from the land when we land apply it. However, it still may be plant available. So with our current data up to day 28, our results indicate that the calcium rate would be the limiting factor because of the calcium displacing the magnesium. So when determining our application rate of the spent gypsum. So at our agronomic rates of calcium, that's the low rate, the 2.5 tons per acre, the spent gypsum did not appear to significantly alter the soil test P concentrations. But once again, we're waiting on the long-term data out past day 28 to determine what happens and to see if gypsum can increase the P buffering capacity of the soil. Little shameless plug here for myself. I'll be presenting more of this information. I did a sequential extraction of some of these soils that I'll be presenting in a poster session tomorrow, which is looking at the changes in phosphorus forms over time. So what I did was a sequential fractionation of these to look at the different phosphorus forms to try to pinpoint what's going on and consider some of the environmental implications of that. So if you're interested in hearing more about that, and I can go into more detail at that time, that will be 4 to 6 tomorrow in Exhibit Hall BC. And make my acknowledgments here. And of course, if anyone has any questions, I'll try to field them.